Hello, and thank you for joining this MedCast series entitled Emerging Agents in the Treatment of Gout. I'm Dr. Nihat Solomon. I'm a rheumatologist and associate professor of medicine at Midwestern University, Arizona College of Osteopathic Medicine, and adjunct faculty for the University of Arizona Rheumatology Division. I'm part of Arizona Arthritis Rheumatology Associates and practice at the Phoenix and Glendale locations.
And I am Dr. Andrew Sharabim. I am a rheumatologist at Arizona Arthritis and Rheumatology Associates and also practice at the Phoenix and Glendale locations. I'm an associate professor of medicine at Midwestern University, Arizona College of Osteopathic Medicine, and an adjunct faculty for the University of Arizona Rheumatology Division.
In this program, our discussion will focus on emerging treatment options for gout, tips for monitoring and managing gout in patients with comorbid conditions. To help us in our conversation about gout, we're joined today by Dr. Gordon Lamb. Dr. Lamb is a rheumatologist at Arthritis and Osteoporosis Consultants of the Carolinas, based in Charlotte, North Carolina. Thank you so much for joining us. Let's begin. So, Gordon, tell us a little bit about the prevalence of gout in the United States and what proportion of patients with gout also present with comorbid conditions at the time of diagnosis.
Sure, I'll be happy to. Let me first start by saying thank you guys for having me. It's a real pleasure and honor to be here. One, to talk about gout, but also because like you, Nihad and Andy, I am a really big proponent of gout and gout management. Gout's one of my favorite diseases to treat. It's so gratifying and satisfying to treat these patients. But what's probably the most exciting is these emerging treatments. You know, we now have the ability to treat gout to a functional cure. We're talking about remission, which makes treating these gout patients even that much more fun and exciting and gratifying. So it's a great pleasure to be here. You know, gout, I don't have to tell you two, is the most common inflammatory arthritis. So data from the 2019 NHANES study showed that the prevalence of gout in the U.S. is about 3.9%. So that equates to about 9.2 million patients here in the U.S. I personally think that that's an underestimate. At least it feels like an underestimate to me. Although interestingly, that study was a self-report, and usually self-reported studies are an overestimate. But the reason why I think it's an underestimate is because that same study said that there were about 20. The prevalence of hyperuricemia was 20%. So that equates to 47 million Americans. And gout is simply the clinical manifestation of hyperuricemia. Hyperuricemia is a necessary precursor to gout. So it makes me think that the overall burden of gout in the United States is a lot higher. But it just goes to show that there's probably a lot more work that we need to that needs to be done with regard to diagnosis and identifying these patients and then filtering down to treatment. And then Nihad, your next question was, I think, about comorbidities. Yeah. So this is where I get really excited with some of our historical research in gout. So we've known for decades that gout is associated with diseases like heart disease, hypertension, congestive heart failure, atrial fibrillation, diabetes, metabolic syndrome, fatty liver, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And this was sort of curated by the NHANES study, but back in 2008-2009, Zhu and colleagues published their report, and they had noted that the incidence of hypertension in gout patients was as high as 74%. The incidence of chronic kidney disease was 71%. Diabetes was about 26%, and heart disease was about 25%. So there is definitely an association. But this is where it gets even more exciting, is that we know that there's an association, but the next question is there a causation of hyperuricemia and these comorbidities? And part of this was based on more recent data showing that patients with gout have a 2 times greater risk of mortality from cardiovascular disease. If a patient presents with a tophus at diagnosis, they have a 3 times greater risk of mortality. And then some of the latest data that was most surprising for me was that the mortality rate increases by 9% for every milligram per deciliter of uric acid that a patient has in gout. So there's a mortality risk. And data dating all the way back to 2008, some from researchers at UCLA, showed that hyperuricemia could induce the proliferation of vascular smooth muscle cells, and that may be a mechanism behind heart disease. And then that same year, researchers at the University of Miami showed that nitric oxide may be impaired by uric acid. So not only can that cause vasoconstriction, but that could cause endothelial damage. And actually, endothelial damage is some of the new targets that we're looking at for novel emerging gout, potential gout treatments. So the association has definitely been established. Whether or not it's causative, I think that data still needs to be, it still needs to be worked out. But the potential is there. And if we can treat gout, the potential downstream mechanisms and sequelae is just even more exciting about the impact on all these other comorbidities.
Certainly exciting. It sounds like we've got our work cut out for us. But first and foremost, finding these patients, right? Because as you mentioned, the prevalence seems to be understated. And so with that, I guess the next question really is, what types of diagnostic tools do we have outside of the clinical exam and history taking? Have you, Andy or Gordon, utilized any new modalities, whether it be biomarkers or whether it be imaging techniques to help classify and find these patients? And what else could be done?
Yeah, and as Gordon was suggesting or stated, is that the it is understated, and of course the prevalence seems to be much higher, you know, clinically and of course anecdotally. And so when I do find, and I find it to be quite uncanny, when I use these imaging modalities such as ultrasounds and such as DECTs or dual energy CTs, I find that there are so much more gout patients and gout to be discovered than meets the eye. The unaided eye is no longer so useful for us to elucidate almost like a tophi on exam. And therefore, we need these imaging modalities to find that double contour sign for us, to find that deposition and to delineate between calcium and uric acid deposition. And I've found myself diagnosing gout more often than previous because of the advent of such modalities and what we've uncovered.
Yeah, it sounds like waiting for that tophi might be a little too late, right? So someone once said, all gout is tophaceous, you just have to know where to look.
Yeah, exactly. Right?
So what do you think, Gordon?
So I always said that diagnosing gout is easy, but it's hard. And it's easy because we can diagnose gout with pretty much 100% accuracy, 100% positive predictive value with things like imaging, tophi, aspiration, demonstrating uric acid crystals, the typical clinical history, et cetera. But it's hard because we have to get these patients, they have to be referred to us in the first place. The majority of gout kind of gets hung up in primary care, and that's fine. But it's usually until they get to the rheumatologist that we can sort of optimize care and take the bigger picture into mind. So diagnostic imaging really comes into play because it's a great diagnostic biomarker. It can allow us to diagnose patients earlier. Historically, imaging used to be just radiographs. But by the time you saw an erosion or even a tophus on radiographs, the horse is out of the barn, damage is done. The newer imaging, so Andy, you mentioned ultrasound and DEC, has really moved the needle. With ultrasounds, it's very sensitive, very specific. Seeing that double contour sign or that train track sign is practically pathognomonic for gout. But ultrasound has its limitations. You can just do a few joints at a time. It's time intensive. There can be inner user variability. But it's inexpensive, there's no radiation, you know, all the other attributes, it's great. Dual energy CT scans, or DECT scans, DECT scans, are very useful. I say that it's a new technology from an old technology, because it's basically, as you know, CTs, but just with two X-ray beams catching images simultaneously, position 90 degrees from each other at different energy levels, so 140 and 80 megavolts. And then using a computer generated algorithm, we can discern uric acid deposition versus, like, say, calcium. We can create these amazing 3D images of the joint with the uric acid deposition overlaid, and we can literally see inside the body. DECT scans are great, they're very useful, but they have limitations too. So for example, there is a high radiation burden, there may be high cost. There is a lower limit of detection to about 2 millimeters, but, you know, 2 millimeters, that's not bad. But also, DECT scans may not necessarily catch uric deposition very early on in disease. So I guess in an ideal world, you would combine both ultrasound and DEXA scans, but to this day, I don't know anyone who's necessarily doing that. But in terms of diagnostic capabilities, it really has moved the needle.
So as you order a DEXA scan or an ultrasound at baseline to get an understanding of what's happening, how often do you repeat them?
That's a great question, because now not only do these imaging modalities serve as diagnostic biomarkers, but they may also serve as pharmacodynamic biomarkers, that is, responsive therapy. And now there's being some discussion as to whether or not they're a criterion for remission, that is to show complete resolution. So I think oftentimes, if you have access to ultrasounds, we may repeat it just to see responsive therapy, just to discern if someone's coming in with a flare, if it's a flare of their gout versus something else. Dual energy CT scans may be harder. Some people may have limitations to access. Of course, we're always concerned about radiation burden and costs. Although dual energy CT scans, I'll have to admit, are easy to do. You know, you can do DEC protocols for gout where they do bilateral hands, wrists, knees, feet, and ankles, and you can get a very good sort of gestalt of a patient's overall uric acid burden in those particular joints, and they're done very quickly. But in terms of practicality of repeat imaging, I think that's still limited, and I think that's still evolving in our community.
So let's talk a little bit more about treatment for our patients with gout and what those unmet needs are. But beyond that, use of active therapies that are approved, and then things on the horizon.
Yeah, so it's important to realize, and we have this discussion with our patients primarily, and also I guess with referring providers, that in treating gout, there are two main points. One is to treat the acute gout flare, and the second is to treat the underlying root cause of gout, which is the hyperuricemia. To treat the acute gout flare, again, it's easy, but it's hard. It's easy because we have four main modalities, whether it be corticosteroids, NSAIDs, colchicine, and then now IL-1 inhibitors. Canakinumab was recently approved in August for the treatment of acute gout flares. But once you resolve the acute gout flare, we have to address the underlying root cause, which is the hyperuricemia. And then again, that it's easy, but it's hard. We have three different classes, xanthine oxidase inhibitors, and the medicines in that class would be primarily allopurinol and febuxostat, uricosurics, things like probenecid and lesinurad, although we don't really use uricosurics much. And then for refractory or difficult to treat or uncontrolled gout, the biologic, pegloticase, and there are new emerging evolutions to that as well. But you kind of have to treat both sides of the coin. If you just treat the acute gout flares without treating the underlying hyperuricemia, then you miss the root cause. If you treat the underlying hyperuricemia, then that may trigger acute gout flares via mobilization flares. You really have to do both and do it in a very sequenced and methodical manner.
So some new things are both freshly approved, IL-1 antagonist, right? And also on the horizon, you mentioned uricosurics, which we don't use much, but the URAT1 inhibitors that are being actively studied that seem to be a little bit easier to use, less problematic than some of the older ones. Can you comment a little bit about those?
So it was exciting, although we've kind of have thought that IL-1 inhibition would be appropriate for the use of acute gout flares. Problems, of course, would be access and cost. But it is very useful for acute flares. We know that IL-1 is one of the main pro-inflammatory cytokines in acute gout flares, you know, stimulated by the NLRP3 inflammasome. Although that same mechanism has been implicated in other disease states, pseudogout, periodic fever syndromes, etc. So it was great to see that it was approved. The ACR had conditionally recommended it for acute gout flares, but only after NSAIDs, steroids, and colchicine. And then its approval is in patients who can't tolerate NSAIDs, steroids, and colchicine. So it does have its use in that particular population. The new emerging therapies for against URAT1, that transporter has always been exciting. And for me, it seems reasonable and plausible because the majority of hyperuricemia in gout is due to not an overproduction of uric acid, but an under-excretion. Mainly because as we get older, kidney function declines, we can't clear uric acid as much. And uric acid deposition may theoretically further impair renal function. So it's this catch-22. So trying to find mechanisms to improve the uric acid excretion just seems intuitive and obvious. So newer agents like We have lesinurad, we have verinurad. There are other mechanisms like arhalofenate. Those are very exciting. Studies are being done, and we'll see how they come to fruition, but more importantly, to see how we use them. I think one of the greatest underutilized mechanisms is combination therapy, combining both a xanthine oxidase inhibitor and a uricosuric to target both the overproduction and under excretion of uric acid. Kind of like how back in the day we would use combination therapy a lot in, like, say, rheumatoid arthritis. I think most rheumatologists like me like to think in terms of analogy, so combination therapy just seems like a natural way to go.
You know, there was a drug a few years ago that combined allopurinol and lisinurad, Duzalo, I think it was called, but then somehow it kind of fell off the market. So it's interesting that you bring up combination therapy, and hopefully we'll see more of that coming forward. But in the meantime, how do you deal with your treatment-resistant gout population?
So treatment-resistant, so gout patients historically have been notoriously some of the most difficult patients to treat. A lot of that may have been based on adherence or non-adherence, but a lot of that could have just been due to pathophysiology and the disease itself. So number one is we want to make sure that education, communication is good, that patients are taking the medicines the way that they're supposed to. But if they truly are treatment refractory, difficult to treat, or uncontrolled, and we actually do have definitions for uncontrolled gout. You know, if you can't get their uric acid level to less than 6, if they still have ongoing signs and symptoms of disease, so for example, more than 2 flares a year, if they have non-resolving tophi, if they have persistent uric acid deposition, then they can be uncontrolled gout. And then we can turn to some of the advanced therapies like biologics, things like pegloticase. That's been a real game changer as well. As you folks know, pegloticase is a recapitulation of uricase, which is an enzyme that we as humans lost in evolution about 15 to 17 million years ago. So researchers at Duke, like John Sundy and Mike Hirschfield, sort of recapitulated it. It's a recombinant mammalian, so porcine-derived uricase. They encapsulated it with polyethylene glycol. The reason to do that is to increase solubility and stability, to decrease immunogenicity. Although ironically enough, we now know that a lot of anti-drug antibodies are directed against the pegylation itself, just because many of us have been exposed to pegylation in various sundries and products and already have preformed antibodies to PEG. Uricase cleaves uric acid, which for us is the end product appearing catabolism, to allantoin, which is very water soluble. So it can literally get uric acid levels down to low levels like 0 within a matter of hours. It's really been a game changer. I like to say that it has sort of turned back the evolutionary clock 15 to 17 million years to give us back this enzyme that we lost. So that can be used for refractory or difficult to treat gout patients.
Andy, have you any experience with this pegloticase?
Yes, I actually anecdotally have used it quite often for that reason. I mean, as I like to say, we like to hit hard and hit fast, right? Because there's no time to waste. You know, you alluded to the fact that gout is not just gout, right? It's not just about the joints. It's about the cardiovascular implications and the comorbid conditions that we have to also lower the risk of. And with the advent, of course, with these imaging modalities that we can use to detect tophi where we can't with the unaided eye, it allows us to, again, hit hard, hit fast. And with pegloticase on the market, with the immunomodulation efforts, we have seen game-changing and life-altering capabilities for these modalities in the combo, in that these patients are getting rid of these tophi quicker. Debilitating disease is no longer refractory and no longer lasting for years. And we see within 6 months to a year that these patients are getting their lives back. So it's great stuff, and it's exciting.
So, you know, you bring up some really good points, you know, to hit early, hit hard. So I've always thought that for any disease, well, a couple points, for any disease, our goal should be cure. But for diseases for which there's not yet a cure, which is pretty much all of our rheumatic diseases, the penultimate goal should be remission. And then the reason why to hit early and hit hard is you want to treat aggressively, but appropriately, but you want to do so to establish a low set point of disease. And therefore, it allows the patient a greater chance to achieve remission. And in gout particularly, the goal of remission, the benefits of remission are, number one, to really functionally cure patients from these debilitating pain syndromes that you know, they liken to having a bone broken or stepping on shards of glass or being scalded with hot water to decrease the impairment not only in their lives and the function of their lives, but that of their family, to help decrease the indirect costs as well as direct costs, but also because of the comorbidities that you had mentioned as well. You know, again, we haven't really shown a direct causation of hyperuricemia to these other comorbidities, but there are some really interesting studies done a long time ago. You know, the decreasing uric acid levels may decrease blood pressure. There's been controversial data about the effects of decreasing uric acid and improvements in kidney function. But still, the potential is very enticing, but I think that just kind of adds to the impetus, to the urgency of treating the disease aggressively and early to prevent these damage.
Agree more.
And utilizing these drugs oftentimes comes at the tail end of not being able to use prior drugs again because of failure, because of intolerance, because of reactions to these other drugs. And so that brings me to the next question is how long can you use pegloticase for, and with or without immunomodulation, how do you choose? Are there a subset of patients that you shouldn't use immunomodulation? Do you just use it on everybody? How much? Which drug? Are there any guidelines on
that? That's a great question. Okay, so Nihad, you know, because uricase is an enzyme that we lost 15 to 17 million years ago, theoretically, it should be 100% immunogenic. It's not native to man. And then when you add the pegylation, which ironically and paradoxically can also cause the formation of antidrug antibodies, we've seen the formation of antidrug antibodies to be really high. And in fact, in the original trials with pegloticase, complete responder rate was 42%, which is great. But that means that the overwhelming majority lost response, and it was primarily due to the formation of antidrug antibodies, which led to secondary failure, could also lead to infusion reactions. So some of the game-changing aspects were to add immunomodulatory therapy, which, to be honest with you, isn't a new concept. We've been doing this in like rheumatoid arthritis ever since the first generation TNF inhibitors came out, where we knew that medicines like methotrexate decreased immunogenicity, decreased the formation of antidrug antibodies, and in doing so, it caused a synergistic effect for efficacy and also improve safety. So even though this concept was known, it wasn't until John Botson and John Peterson in Alaska and Seattle respectively actually did the trial. And they showed that in gout, it was a game changer. So not surprisingly, adding methotrexate to pegloticase improved efficacy, almost doubling it. And just as importantly, improved safety, decreasing infusion reactions from 31% to 4%. So now, to answer your other question, immunomodulation is used pretty much routinely in all patients on pegloticase. In fact, team from Horizon, now Amgen, is going to be showing data of the increased use of immunomodulation with their product, Krystexxa. And then I think in the community, the uptake has been very avid and very enthusiastic among community and academic rheumatologists.
Any other uricases on the horizon and with this concept of combination of immunomodulation?
There are. So there is pedraticase, and that is a different uricase. Instead of it being derived from mammals, so porcine derived, it's derived from Canada utilis. And its sort of immunomodulatory agent is ImmTOR. So ImmTOR is just biodegradable nanoparticles that encapsulate rapamycin. So this is another strategy to decrease immunogenicity. Rapamycin, which has been used a lot in transplant biology, has been shown to decrease T cell activation, but also via tolerogenic aspect, it can increase regulatory T cells. So thereby further controlling, blunting an abnormal immune response. The interesting thing is this technology, so nanoparticle encapsulated rapamycin, is also being used in other, is being considered in other disease states to decrease immunogenicity. So a lot of the technology that's being used, a lot of the new mechanisms of action, new theories are being utilized for other disease states as well. So I think this really could really change the landscape of not just gout and gout immunology, but other immune-mediated inflammatory diseases.
So you know what's interesting about gout is that it's an old disease, and sometimes old is gold, as they say, right? So bringing back some of these older therapies, years ago, ACTH, for example, was used to protract acute gout, and then it sort of was lost by the, fell by the wayside. Are there any avenues by which to bring back some of the old stuff, some of the commonly used drugs for other reasons, antihypertensives, like the Losartan, for example? What do you think? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, so there's a number of avenues and mechanisms being evaluated. So Losartan, an angiotensin receptor blocker, has been known to be mildly uricosuric. Oftentimes, though, in clinical practice, we've been using it in place of in place of other medications, like, say, if it's appropriate, if it's not for heart failure, in place of, like, say, a diuretic. You know, we know that thiazide and loop diuretics can increase gout by increasing the concentration of uric acid. Things like using niacin, which may not be as urate retentive as, like, other medications for hyperlipidemia, hypertriglyceridemia, could be a consideration. But other pathways, the old pathways like xanthine oxidase inhibitors, there are studies being done for novel xanthine oxidase inhibitors, things like engineered urate oxidase, and just pathways in that same pathway, other novel uricosurics, as we talked about before. So finding newer molecules in established pathways, and that can just contribute to our overall armamentarium to treat gout.
Yeah. And to say, Andy, I'd like to hear from you about any challenges that you have in monitoring your patients who have gout, and any advice that you can give our audience to effective ways to maintain their adherence to therapies and positive outcomes.
Yeah, like Gordon mentioned, gout patients are notorious for not being able to adhere to even follow-ups in the clinic. We have this, it's sort of an epidemic, and it's still ongoing. I mean, our first course of action is to allow more for that rapport and that trust to be built at first. And then secondly would be to ensure that they have the appropriate support to make it, especially if they're getting those infusions every 2 weeks. They have to dedicate time, and you have to at least lay that all out for them so they understand what they're getting into, but understanding the benefits of all of this, why they're committing so much time. So I think it's paramount to build that rapport, build that trust, so at least they get that foundation. So that they can actually see that you want to enhance and enrich their lives, and therefore, like you said, by direct effect, helping their families out, because that is a burden not only on the patient but to those who support them and the surrounding nuclear and extended families that bear the brunt of that burden as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, monitoring and treating gout can be challenging, although a lot of the reasons are the same in many other disease states, but they seem to be amplified in gout. So they actually looked at this, not in a formal way, but there are patient-facing obstacles as well as provider-facing obstacles that can lead to difficulties in monitoring and treating gout. So patient-facing obstacles could be things, as you mentioned, you know, behavioral issues, supportive issues, stigma of gout. You know, a lot of times when a gout patient flares, it's blamed on something that they did, that they ate, when actually the main risk factors for gout are age and genetics, which you really can't, are non-modifiable. There are other things, like, for example, maybe socioeconomic status, location. If they're in a pharmacy desert or a medicine desert, that's not their fault at all. But then there are provider-facing issues, which we're all complicit in, you know, things like maybe knowledge gaps, things like trust issues, things like access, costs of medication, costs of healthcare, communication, which we can definitely improve as well. But at the root cause of both is adherence. A medication won't work if they're not taking it. And the adherence rates in gout, or not surprisingly, are the same as adherence rates in like other disease states, like say rheumatoid arthritis. So in 2016, Jeff Curtis down in Alabama, Jeff's a good friend, published a paper, and he showed that in methotrexate utilization in rheumatoid arthritis patients, adherence rates could be as low as 50% at 1 year and as low as 25% at 5 years. And we've seen similar numbers in gout as well. So the question is, well, how do you improve them? And it could be, it's not just asking. You can't just say, are you taking your medicines? Of course, they're going to say yes. There has to be other creative ways to ascertain that and then to sort of motivate the patients to take it. But what I've found, and I'm sure you folks have found it as well, is that in gout patients, once they start doing well, they become the most adherent patients because they're doing so well, they're feeling so great, they're not having gout flares, they're seeing their tophi shrink, that they come to every visit. They want to see what their new uric acid level is. They want to make sure they take their medicines. So it's kind of that success begets success. And it's, instead of it being a vicious cycle downward, it becomes a virtuous cycle upward. And again, that goes to the satisfaction and gratification and fun of treating gout patients.
Yeah, so with that, let's sort of think about what are some of the important considerations in managing our gout patients who have comorbid conditions such as diabetes, chronic kidney disease, etc. And what are some good tips we can give our audience?
Yeah, so this is really important. It may not necessarily be as important for rheumatologists because I would think that we understand these nuances, but more so for primary care. So gout is not one size fits all. You really have to take a personalized approach in treating our gout patients, which is consistent with a personalized approach in all of medicine. So for example, I'd mentioned that 71% of gout patients have chronic kidney disease. So therefore, you should be really judicious in your use of NSAIDs. I'd mentioned that 26% of gout patients have diabetes. So in those patients, you should be really judicious about your use of steroids. You know, colchicine may be an appropriate issue, but if they have GI issues or adverse events, then you have to take that into account as well. So it really is a personalized approach to each patient. It could be concerns of side effects, you know, whether they have potential side effects from the medications. There could be genetic attributions as well. You know, for example, we know that in high-risk Asian populations, they may be at greater risk for allopurinol hypersensitivity syndromes. So therefore, checking the HLA B5801 is recommended. So you really have to take all of these personalized approaches in each of our gout patients. It's not a one-size-fits-all.
Yes. So finally, I'd like to recap with final thoughts and get some insights from both Andy and Gordon.
I feel we had great conversations today, and it keeps you hopeful for what's to come in the future. And I think that with what is to come in our armamentarium and building and bolstering it, I feel that our patients are more than likely to be enhanced in with respect to their quality of life. And of course, you know, notating that we have to build that rapport with them, we have to build that trust, and of course, navigating the issues at hand that bar or that keep us from allowing them to be adherent to said medications and modalities that we have currently. So I feel that right now we have enough to at least build that, but I do believe with the advent of all these new mechanisms of action and of course building off of what we already do know from 15 to 17 million years ago onward, I think that it is, again, as I always repeated today, that it is exciting to be in the field of medicine, especially rheumatology.
Mm-hmm. Yep, gout's fun. You know, patients come in with the worst pain ever. We've seen them. They come in hobbling in crutches and wheelchairs. You know, so I'm in North Carolina. It does snow there. They'll cut the toes out of their shoes in the dead of winter. They come in wearing flip-flops. And they can go from the very worst phenotype, worst pain ever, to being completely asymptomatic within a matter of hours and days. Not very many disease states you can affect such a dramatic change from one extreme to the other. Gout's one of them. And now that we have so many other possibilities and options and things on the horizon, and makes treating it fun. But to kind of, Neha, to your point, to recap, we have to do it properly. We have to diagnose patients early and accurately. We have to treat them aggressively and early to establish that lower set point of disease, to minimize that total body uric acid burden. We have to utilize the medications in a methodical and logical manner. You know, with oral urate-lowering therapies, whether it be xanthine oxidase inhibitors or uricosurics, if we can't get them to goal, so again, adopting to treat the target therapy, then using combination therapy, escalating appropriately, avoiding treatment inertia, and then moving on to biologics if appropriate, using the biologics appropriately with immunomodulation to increase efficacy and safety, and then if all else fails, then to kind of turn to the agents that we have on the horizon, which may further move the needle and improve our ability to treat these patients.
Indeed, agreed. I'll leave everyone with this final thought, sort of a case of mine. A gentleman appeared to me about a year and a half ago with a baseball-sized tophi on his great toe. Not sure how he allowed it to get that big. Was referred to me by a podiatrist, had never been on any gout therapy. We aggressively treated him, and appropriately, I believe so. And over the course of the year and a half, he now fits into shoes. He was not able to wear shoes. He had to have these makeshift Crocs that he'd cut the tips at so his feet could fit. And he came in tears saying, "This medication and you have changed my life." So it's really exciting and very gratifying to be able to offer such therapies and novel approaches to our patients.
Hear, hear.
And with that, thank you everybody for tuning in to our session with MedCast.